May we be reminded here now of our highest aspirations and inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we know that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other. Let's sing.
Hearing the notion that knowing your nugget, your core values, is helpful when navigating the many choices and freedoms that face us, I was struck by the paradox that in my life, it has often been facing choices that has helped me actually discover and define my nugget. Indeed, it seems that choices and values are somewhat interdependent. Choices push us to contemplate values as well as the other way around. I got my BA in a program titled Rhetoric and Professional Writing. Rhetoric having the classical definition of the art of persuasion, rather than the contemporary popular meaning of someone trying to deceive. The program's course provided a broad foundation for a writing career in any number of areas, from writing those wonderful software manuals to political speech writing, to advertising, copywriting, and so on. However, we were all reminded, particularly in our introductory courses, that once we had accepted a job, our focus would be on helping the employer to get their message across convincingly, whether we agreed with it or not. It all seemed too mercenary for me, like we were just communication guns for hire. I discovered that at my core, it was important for me to have personal meaning in my work, to help others and to foster independent thinking. With this nugget in mind, I chose to go into teaching. When I was completing my Bachelor of Education degree, preparing to teach high school 9 years ago in Canada, teachers were given quite a bit of freedom and trust in developing their own teaching styles and evaluation methods. We were encouraged to be creative and thoughtful, giving students many choices to suit their individual strengths as we developed lessons and assignments. But as we all know, knowing your nugget and living by it every day is quite different. And there's the rub. In the real world of full-time teaching, it seemed that many of us, at least some of the time, followed along well-worn traditional paths, simply out of default rather than thoughtful choice. After all, it can be hard to find extra energy for creativity when you're buried in a mountain of essays that are waiting to be marked. Now I'm engaged in a new adventure. I'm writing a novel, and knowing my nugget is becoming even more important to me, as a book invites a world of criticism and comments. Along with, hopefully, some people liking the book, I know there will be some people who won't. In my mind, I can already hear some of the comments, and I have already thought about how I'll respond to them. My nugget seems pretty clear to me. In writing my novel, my priority has been to create characters who are complex and conflicts that are complicated. In short, I'm aiming for the book to reflect real life. No character is wholly good or wholly bad, and everything isn't cheerily wrapped up in a completely happy ending. Real life is messy, real people are messy, and our complicated world is something to be both examined and celebrated. That's the nugget of truth that has guided me in writing my novel. In pondering the upcoming revising process, I understand that working within your nugget does not mean rejecting all criticism. Rather, knowing your nugget can guide you in recognizing constructive suggestions that will strengthen what you're putting into the world. When I start working with an agent or editor, I anticipate doing rewrites, adding or deleting sections, etc. And I'll make these changes eagerly as long as the writing is made stronger and the nugget of the story remains intact. To me, at this point in my life, knowing my nugget means writing with integrity. In my life overall, I'm thankful for the role that choices and freedoms have played in helping me discover and live by my core values, my nugget. Likewise, I appreciate the guidance that these values will give me as I make more important decisions in the future. I'm sure that as my life moves along, my values and choices will continue to influence each other. We all change, so my nugget 10 years from now might look quite different. Hopefully, over time, it will swell with wisdom and glow with guidance.
Time, the center of our service and the center of our lives, as every moment is. When we take time to light candles of memory and hope for prayers, for people, for moments you want to remember, or you can sit there and remember why you're here. From arrogance, pompousness, and from thinking ourselves more important than we are, may some saving sense of humor liberate us. For allowing ourselves to ridicule the faith of others, may we be forgiven. For making war and calling it peace, special privilege and calling it justice, indifference and calling it tolerance, pollution and calling it progress, may we be cured. For telling ourselves and others that evil is inevitable while good is impossible, may we stand corrected. God of our mixed up, tragic, aspiring, doubting, and insurgent lives, help us to be as good as in our hearts we have always wanted to be. Amen. Your nugget. What does this cutesy sermon title mean, knowing your nugget? When this worship topic was suggested at the winter meeting of the Worship Associates program here at the church, it was expressed as not knowing your nugget, but survival skills. This topic is one of the very few which was suggested by one member of the group and taken on by another member of the Worship Associates group for reflection and writing. Sandy Dennis suggested that a young woman who teaches for the Austin School District on the eastern side of town, she wanted the issues of taking on roles and responsibilities, something we all do as functioning adults living in families and working in communities, to be examined, including especially how hard it can be to find a core self there in us somewhere underneath what might feel like a weight of roles. I think it is a concern many of us can relate to. Knowing our religious center is something Davidson repeats over and over again to everyone who is listening, like a mantra. The core of our being, or the nugget of truth of our own unique individual selves, is there something really there? Is it always there waiting for us to notice? Can we recognize it, quiet down and relax enough to sense it? Or does it speak to us regularly? Is it the guiding light of our lives, the key to our priorities, and the source of our motivation? You have heard Colleen's reflections on the possibilities and direction which have come from her writing and knowing her nugget along the way. And I want to share a story, too. It is the story about how I came to know my last dog, Chef. I first saw Chef one day as I walked along the sidewalk in the industrial neighborhood where I worked in downtown Toronto. I worked in a fancy, artsy animation studio in a large, renovated warehouse. But across the street from the studio, there was a gated yard of a stonemason. It looked pretty rough from across the street, corrugated steel walls, barbed wire atop, run down. The gate was a standard frost fence. Off to the side, there was a steel shed. There was a mountain of peat moss in big square bags off to the rear. Large ground-moving equipment parked haphazardly around. I would never have noticed any of this except one day I looked over and I saw Chef. He was sitting at the gate, sitting quietly and watching the action on the street. He was a pup, maybe 4 months old. He looked like a German shepherd with a big, solid body, huge upright ears, and a dark face and muzzle with light brown eyes. He didn't notice me any more than anyone else on the street, but from that moment I could not forget about him. The next day I went up to the gate to meet him. He was nice. He was chained to the shed with a bare wire, sharp ends jutting out, attaching his collar to the chain. I felt concerned for him. I started to wonder about his owner or caretaker. Was it the owner of the yard? The studio where I worked had a cafeteria in the front of the building on the second floor, overlooking the yard opposite. It gave me a great vantage point, and I began to spy on the operation across the street. It did not take me long to learn that a crew of men arrived early in the morning, parked their vehicles on the street, prepared loads on the trucks, and took one or two of them out all day, returning about 6 o'clock. The pup was acknowledged by these men in a minimal way, and it was fed in the evening. Open a can of dog food, push back the lid, throw it over to the dog. I could not see any sign that the dog was cruelly treated, and he expressed no fear when I visited him through the gate. Now, I was working in those days. I was a production coordinator for one of the departments in the studio. I managed all the storyboards for all the projects that went through the studio. And I had to stay on top of quite a bit, but I certainly had time to watch that dog in that yard and obsess over whether I should get involved and try to improve his lot. It was clear to me that he was set in place to become a guard dog, alone and largely neglected for his whole life. Yet it was equally clear that he was by nature neither fearful nor mean. I felt my concern for him grow to enormous proportions in my life. Should I call the Humane Society? I wondered if I should try to steal the dog. Should I try to make friends with the owner and take care of the dog the best way I could? It wasn't long before I was trespassing. I found a way in over the rear gate one afternoon, and I approached the pup from the inside of the yard. He was happy to see me, clearly excited at the prospect of some company. I sat down on the gravel and dirt beside the shed and pet him. He drank it in. I pulled out an apple and offered him bite-sized pieces of it. He gently explored these and then ate them all up. Then he lay down right beside me close and laid his head on my lap and promptly fell asleep. This experience for me was akin to an epiphany, the experience of seeing God. Webster's defines epiphany as, quote, a sudden intuitive perception of reality or the essential meaning of something often initiated by some simple, commonplace occurrence. Who's had an epiphany here? Come on, let's see. Put those hands up. Oh, okay, a lot of people. The feeling I had then was of joy at the presence of this pure being of love who had just laid himself down on me with a perfect trust. It was a perception of bliss, unexpected but unmistakable. I sat there and let him rest on me for a while, but then I had to go. I did not want to get caught. It was painful to separate from Chef. From that first time of our being together, it was so palpably life-giving that it was almost as if we physically nourished each other. Back in the office, the implications were confusing and they became more urgent. I asked everyone, what should I do about this wonderful pup destined for such a sad fate? My parents, my sisters, my friends, my co-workers. Mostly, people had a hard time understanding why it mattered so much, why I was so impassioned. I could not rest until I responded to the nugget of truth which I witnessed in this creature. It reminds me of the feeling St. Augustine expressed about finally finding rest in his connection to God. I had to do something for this dog. Should I call the Humane Society and subject him to the impersonal safety of an institutional cage? should I try to make friends with the owner and take care of the dog with his permission? To make a long and involved story short, that is what I did. I made friends with Manuel da Costa, a gentle Portuguese man who owned the yard, the trucks, and the dog. And I asked if I could help take care of the dog. I am not sure what he thought about me coming across the street, but he agreed and he gave me a key to his yard. I began to take care of him too. I visited Chef before work, on my breaks, after work, and on weekends. I replaced the wire with proper hardware. I fed him his dinner and started taking him out for walks. I encouraged my dog-loving co-workers who watched all of this while they were drinking their coffee on their coffee breaks and eating their lunches in the cafeteria to take their turn in walking Chef and getting to know him, buying him treats and bringing in old towels. I kept the leash in my desk and folks from all over the studio dropped by to pick it up and take Chef out. Chef became a social butterfly. And I got to know many people at the studio that I previously did not know. When winter came on, my father made Chef a wonderful two-chambered insulated doghouse. We're talking Canada. On the coldest mornings, I would take Chef cooked rolled oats and hot consomme. After work, we would play in the yard and walk the whole neighborhood together until my feet would be so frozen that I could stand the pain no more. But those were very happy times. Chef and I wandered everywhere, old warehouses, parking lots, the meadow hills above the rail tracks and yards. We went into the deserted exposition grounds and from there across to the parklands on the shore of Lake Ontario. For hours every day we explored. I felt safe with Chef. He was 85 pounds as a full-grown dog with an alert, intense gaze. Parting each day was still terrible. Chef knew the routine and that I would be back the next morning, but he would always bark his protest until I was out of earshot. The seasons of a full year passed with this lifestyle. Once Chef da Costa escaped the yard by climbing up the peat moss mountain and jumping down the 10-foot wall to an adjoining parking lot. I remember a frightening search around the warehouses and on the tracks, finding him, and then beginning a slow project of convincing Manuel to neuter him to curb his wandering instincts. I was amazed when he agreed. It was the beginning of Manuel understanding that Chef had become my dog, and when he finally gave Chef to me, Chef came home to stay. And that is where I'll end my Chef story for now. I wanted to tell you this story this morning as an example of how natural and radical it can be to follow the core of our truth. The truth for me was the fact that the little pup sitting at the gate was a stellar canine, good as gold. The truth was that I could get involved with him as much as I wanted to. No holds barred. Conventions be damned. The truth was that I could take care of his needs from across the street doing my job, and that my heart was as thirsty as his to drink in the simple joy of reliable, trusting companionship. My religious value was that there was nothing better, nothing more humanizing, nothing more soul-satisfying for me to do. Now, to switch gears, let us identify and distinguish, if we can, between core values of a religious kind versus those of a social or political kind. Davidson has much to say in this area as well. He figures many Unitarian Universalists, including myself, are pretty confused about the nature of their core values. So, let's take a value we all share, likely, that all people be treated with kindness and respect regardless of the religious ideas they hold. In terms of the UUA's principles and purposes, this value touches on the first principle that affirms the worth and dignity of all people, the second principle that upholds equity and compassion in human relations, the third principle about the practice of acceptance of one another, and the fourth principle which upholds the individual free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Now, how can we tell whether that is a religious value or a social or political value? Well, let's take a clearly religious idea to see if we can clarify the nature of our core values. Let's say I believe the purpose of my life is to love dogs. You do not have this religious value, perhaps, but you are willing to worship with me because you want to have the freedom to hold your own unconventional beliefs, just like I do. We both value this freedom, maybe more than we value the religious ideas we are currently entertaining. We value the basic assumptions that you and I can both handle experiments in thinking, that we can be trusted with trying on different worldviews, that we will not lose our grip on life, that we will not be damned to hell through our inquiry, that we will not hurt others with our thinking. Now, these are religious affirmations. They talk about what we believe human beings are capable of. The principles can be understood as a kind of infrastructure of affirmations to ensure that we have support from our communities regardless of the conventionality of our religious values. We make a commitment to equity and acceptance in relations with one another to pave the way for personal freedom to wonder about life. Wondering about life is a religious value. I take a path of communion with a befriended guard dog, and that is the core truth I bring to the table. You witness another religious idea that you do not necessarily buy, but you stay committed to equity and acceptance just the same. That does start to sound like a social and political value, social in the concern for the well-being of all, political in the implied sharing of power by all, the power to accept one another. Is it because we believe the individual search for truth and meaning will result in people finding their core value and living it? I think so. How did Davidson say it last week? What do we serve with our time? What gods or high ideals do we dedicate ourselves to? What truths about life do we believe and let our lives amplify? Life is good. Healing is possible. Prayer is transformative. Love is surprising and expanding. You can carry on with a lot of simple sentences of your own. My adventures with Chef revealed other nuggets of truth, too, for me, that people are trustworthy, that we can do a lot with small efforts, that love never fails. Liberal religious values are served by our commitments to socially and politically empowering relationships, but we also need wisdom to recognize our core religious values. We all need a North Star to orient us and help us navigate life according to the most fundamental truths of our being. And this has been the role of religion through the ages and the function of religious values. Now, I want to return to my story about Chef and take a look at the guidance I received at the time from a source of human wisdom called the I Ching. The I Ching, or the Book of Changes, is one of the most ancient texts of China. It is a complex book which likely emerged out of centuries of divination and oral tradition, with legendary authors and layers of commentary revealing Taoist, Buddhist, and Confucian worldviews. Confucius himself was said to have worked through and worn out 3 copies of the I Ching. I was introduced to the I Ching by a friend of mine, a co-worker, an older woman who was a free thinker, a martial artist, a dramatic person who understood life as a stage. She gave me the I Ching workbook by R.L. Wing and a set of color-coded beads with which she taught me to use the book as an oracle. I did not ask her for these things. It was not for a birthday present. It was just a case of pure grace. She herself used the I Ching for guidance through confusion and difficulty, and I learned from her how to consult the text and how to frame questions in making an inquiry. I began to use the I Ching in the spring of 1987, not long before I started work at the animation studio. And it was the following October that I asked the question of the I Ching, what is the best approach to take to Chef? How much of my time do I give to this dog? Now, by that time, I had decided to get involved in his life, but I felt I needed guidance in determining how he should rate in terms of my priorities. Without going into a technical explanation of how answers are found in the I Ching, I want to share the answers I got to this particular question. The first was the idea of subordination. Subordination is a necessary condition for many people in many situations whenever they are subject to conditions over which they have no control. Often the roles we play in a family or organization require our subordination. The time of subordination is one where we try to be content with fulfilling our role. Our capacities to plan and execute our plans must wait until circumstances change. The guidance I took from this was that to continue on with the role I had taken on as chef's caretaker within the limitations and subordinating myself to the limitations of his continuing role as the guard dog for Manuel da Costa. The second answer I got concerned great power. When the oracle offers a second idea to consider, it is understood as an indicator of future developments on the subject of inquiry. So the notion of great power following subordination held promise. Great power is a true test of a person's character. Great power can lead to progress and enlightenment or to chaos and evil. Therefore, it is very important to have honorable motives and demonstrate correct behavior at such a time of great power, considering always propriety and goodness. The promise of great power is that by bringing progress to others, you strengthen your own sense of well-being. The guidance I took here was to proceed naturally in the relationship with Chef with care and to trust the process and perhaps progress of our growing friendship. As you can see, the nature of the answers and the guidance given by the I Ching is open to interpretation and is very much oriented to contemplation. Over the years, I have found that very helpful. When I get to a place which feels stuck, or when I have to face a situation that confuses me, I have found consulting the I Ching, the process of retreat and ritual it requires, the reflection which is needed to articulate the central question, and the contemplation which is needed to ingest the answers, to be a very comforting and reliable source of guidance. And that may be because it is in the tough personal work of framing our own questions that we have the chance to recognize our own deepest yearnings and highest callings. More than any other ancient text, it has provided for me a sage perspective to the small troubles of my life. Like the wisdom traditions of all the world's religions, it offers the observations and intelligences of countless generations just for the asking. The I Ching expresses some Far Eastern cosmologies, which I want to highlight very briefly for you because they have provided for me useful variations on the Western worldview, religious worldviews, which have a separate creator God showing up to make and control everything. There is still a divine realm, the realm of the invisible to which humanity is connected. There is the earthly realm as well, where we dwell. Humanity itself becomes the connection between the two realms, complete with all the impulses and instincts of our nature, as well as the limitations and fates of our individual lives. Cosmic order is a matter of the harmony which is possible when the development of the individual matches the needs of the cosmos or the condition of heaven and earth around them. The source of such cosmic order is envisioned as a well, a deep, inexhaustible source of nourishment. The town can be moved, just as we can trade religious ideas, perhaps, but not the well. No, the well must always be returned to, for that is the source of nourishment. The source, in this worldview, contains and is born of the collective truth of humanity, and it both receives from the individual's experience and gives to the individual's nature. Penetrating the source of human meaning can be seen as the major theme of Chinese philosophy, just as loving God can be seen as the major theme of the biblical religions. Just listen now to the bittersweet sentiment of a rabbi who knows his nugget. He says, "While I was young, when I burned with the love of God, I thought I would convert the whole world to God. But soon I realized it would be more than enough to convert the people who just lived in my town. And I made an effort for a long time, but I was not successful. Then I realized that my agenda was still too ambitious, and I focused on the people in my own household. But I could not convert them either. Finally, I realized I must work on myself if I'm really going to have something to offer to God. But I didn't even accomplish this." In this one sad cry, we hear the core religious values of love of God and the core religious value of always cleaving to the truth of the self in relation to God or the cosmos. And religions are expressions and servants of the human quest to reach out beyond the horizon of self and self-interest, no matter how badly they or we do. Knowing your nugget might not be easy or straightforward or even possible at times, but if you can become acquainted with the truth which connects you to the whole enterprise of living and dying, the whole mixed bag of the human condition, and if you can keep connected with it, you will find guidance as you negotiate the freedoms, roles, and responsibilities life presents us all with. What is it you have to offer to God? Or how is it you might serve your highest ideals or the truth of your own authentic being? What are the epiphanies of your life? Are you ready to know your nugget? I will end with the popular mystic poet of Islam, Rumi's advice, when it comes to recognizing the religious values at the core of your being. He said, "Let yourself be silently drawn by the stronger pull of what you really love."